covered most of the new developments in any control gate theory. I try to keep the lectures kind of self-contained, although I also do not want to spend time on a review of supersymmetric gauge theory. Rather, I will present at the beginning of each lecture the basic facts that I will need about supersymmetry and supersymmetric gauge theories, which I will need for the rest of the lectures. Today, I would like to start by introducing a certain interesting class of theories. I want to answer a very simple question. What is the behavior under S-duality of any Schuh gauge theories? And just by trying to answer this question with very basic, under very basic assumptions, I want to show that you can derive the existence of a very large and interesting class of field theories, which will be the main actors of the remaining lectures. So today will be about S-duality. In the next tomorrow, I will introduce more of the machinery of Cyber-Witten to describe the low energy theory behavior of these theories. On Wednesday, I plan to introduce a certain six-dimensional construction to define and describe these theories in a sort of uniform manner. And then for the last two lectures, I will cover respectively supersymmetric extended operators in any culture based theories, such as surface operators, line operators, and then the connection to Liouville theory and other two-dimensional conformal field theories. I want to say sorry in advance if my voice is a little bit troubled this morning. I hope that things will get better during the week. Now, so what do I mean with S-duality? S-duality is a strongly coupled duality. I mean, I define S-duality as a strongly coupled duality, strongly coupling duality for a theory with an exactly marginal parameter, exactly marginal coupling. So the idea is that you start with a theory with some marginal coupling in some region for some values of the coupling for which you admit a useful weakly coupled description of the theory. And then you tune the gauge coupling, the parameter, to make the theory strongly coupled. The original description of the theory becomes less and less useful as you do that. And if you're having an S-duality, means that some new degrees of freedoms emerge as strong coupling. And in terms of those degrees of freedom, the theory should be again weakly coupled. So these degrees of freedoms might be completely different from the original degrees of freedom. They might, the S-duality might involve some electromagnetic duality. So these might be magnetically charged particles in the original theory. And so in general, if you have a theory with S-duality, you expect to see a picture of this sort. We have some big parameter space of couplings, which describes your theory. I mean, all possible deformations, all possible marginal deformations of your theory. And then in each corner of the parameter space, you have some different weakly coupled descriptions, which might or not have the same Lagrangian, like different Lagrangians, completely different degrees of freedom. Each will be a good description of the theory in some region, and then a pretty bad description everywhere else. And right. And hopefully, they actually cover the description, hopefully, more or less cover the whole modular space. But that's actually not obvious, not guaranteed. Usually, if you want to go from a description to the other, because they are very different, you must pass through some region where both descriptions are pretty bad. So you might actually ask, what does it mean to have an S-duality? How do I check if some S-duality is present? And indeed, in most cases, all you can do is to match certain protected quantities computed at different corners of the moduli space. So you might be able to compute the spectrum of protected particles or the spectrum of supersymmetric operators in the various theories. And as far as I know, there is essentially no check that has ever been done of quantities which do not enjoy a certain amount of supersymmetry, simply because you have no way to compute them in these intermediate regions, so you would like to match. Now,
can you just say one word about
this? So I was trying to describe what I mean with textuality. So I was saying it is intended as textuality with strong coupling duality for a theory with a marginal coupling. So I expect, in general, if I have a theory with textuality, I expect to have a certain parameter space of the formations of the theory that will have several corners where some weakly coupled description is available, separated by regions where all the weakly coupled descriptions are pretty bad. So the canonical example of a theory with textuality is n equal 4 square Mills theory, which means maximally supersymmetric gauge theory in four dimensions. This is a theory which is very constrained by supersymmetry. I might occasionally say things that are completely obvious, but I'm not completely sure. I've been told the audience might include people from math. So tell me if everybody feels that I'm saying something completely obvious, please tell me to speed up or anyway. So n equal 4 square Mills is a unique maximally supersymmetric gauge theory in four dimensions. Because of the amount of supersymmetry, it's a very constrained theory. All the fields are in the same supersymmetry multiplet as the gauge fields, which in particular means that they all transform in the joint of the gauge group. And the main consequence of this amount of supersymmetry is that the Lagrangian itself is essentially completely fixed in terms of the gauge kinetic terms. So once you specify your gauge group, the structure of the Lagrangian is fixed. And the Lagrangian only has two couplings, which are, well, apart from some normalization factors, the number which sits in front of the gauge kinetic terms, which is the gauge coupling, and the theta angle which sits in front of the topological density which computes the instanton number of your field theory configuration, which is the theta angle. The trace is normalized in such a way that the one instanton configurations have instanton number one, so that the theta angle has a classical shift symmetry of theta goes to theta plus 2 pi, which leaves the theory invariant, just because you get a factor of e to the 2 pi I in the path integral with just one. So these two couplings are typically combined together into an holomorphic coupling, which tau, and we saw tau is that the theory is invariant under tau goes to tau plus 1. And as duality for n equal 4 super Mills, means that if your gauge group is simply laced, If you start with a weakly coupled theory where G is very small and tau is very close to I infinity, and you go all the way down, so tau lives in that rough plane because the gauge coupling has to be positive for the Lagrangian to make sense. So the theory is weakly coupled as tau goes to I infinity. If you want it, just because in your path integral, you have a 1 over g squared in front of your action. So the classical description of the theory the classical field theory is a good description of your theory as tau goes to I infinity. As tau goes to towards the real axis, the theory becomes very strongly coupled. And you can ask what happens, say, as tau goes to zero. And the statement of this duality is that new dual degrees of freedoms emerge so that you recover the same gauge theory as tau goes to minus, under the transformation, tau goes to minus 1 over tau. So if you combine this tau goes to one over minus 1 over tau with this tau goes to tau plus 1, you can generate a whole SL2Z group of S-duality transformations. So that you essentially find out that the theory is a whole infinite set of other weakly coupled cusps where completely different degrees of freedoms emerge, which are, you know, reassemble the same gauge theory. Yes, such cusps at all at all rational values of the gauge coupling on the real axis. So, so this is what this picture is for n equal 4 super Mills. So, so typically you would actually draw some modular region a little bit arbitrarily. well, doesn't matter really. Okay, so this is really the basic statement about this duality in equal 4 super Mills. You can test this this duality, as I said, in various ways. So originally, the main idea was to check that the spectrum of the theory of mass of protected particles, so the theory would remain invariant under this duality. Then Vafavit then checked that the partition function of a twisted version of this theory has modular properties. If you compactify the theorem certain on a four manifold, on some complex four manifolds, then I don't know, Kapustin and Witten verified that S duality acts nicely on the spectrum of line operators for the theory, and so on and so forth. So for protected quantities, you can say a lot. For non-protected quantities, you can say very little. For example, all this nice technology for computing quantities in equal 4 super Mills in the planar limit is pretty useful to study as duality, because you're really going at an actual strong coupling, not just a strong proof coupling. So now I want to study n equal 2 gauge theories. If you're talking about the gauge theories which have a Lagrangian description, we have a little bit more freedom for n equal 2 theories than we have for n equal 4 theories. Indeed, not n equals 2 supersymmetry does not require all the fields to be in the same supermultiplet as the gauge fields. There are two sort of supermultiplets, two sort of multiplets of particles related by supersymmetry. There are vector multiplets. Which contain the gauge fields. And their super partners, all sitting in the joint representation of the gauge group. And then there are hypermultiplets. Which contain fields which sit in a certain in whatever representation you want of your gauge group, together with the complex conjugate representation. So once you specify the gauge group and the representation, again the structure of the Lagrangian is essentially fixed. So you still have couplings. One for each simple factor in your gauge group. They might or not be exactly marginal, so there is a beta function. While in many false spiral mills, all the coupling was automatically marginal and gave you a parameter based on the formation of the theory. If you want a marginal coupling in equal two gauge theories, you need to select carefully the matter content of the theory. Something else that is a we play a very important role today, is that these theories can have an interesting flavor symmetry, which means that if you have if your representation contains several copies of some irreducible representations, then you get some U and I flavor symmetry for each of these multiple copies, which essentially rotates the various copies of the representation among themselves. If these representations are real, which means that they're conjugate to their conjugate representation, and they're equivalent to the conjugate representations and have a symmetric invariant form, then the flavor symmetry group is enhanced to USP, Chu and I. And if they are pseudo-real, which means they have an anti-symmetric invariant form, then the flavor symmetry group is enhanced to SO, Chu and I. Actually, if the representation is pseudo-real, you can have sort of half of an hypermultiplet, which classically would give you an SO Chu N plus 1 flavor symmetry. But sometimes there are global anomalies which prevent you from that quantum mechanically. So as I said, there are the Lagrangian is given once you fix the gauge group and the represent matter content. The couplings are the gauge couplings. And you also have some master formations which can preserve an equal two supersymmetry and which are in one-to-one correspondence to with the Cartan or the ferrosymmetry group. So what I, as we study S-duality, it will be actually very useful to keep track of how the S-duality acts on the flavor symmetries of the theory. Now, the first example of an equal two gauge theory with S duality is n equal four square mills itself. You can look at this n equal four square mills as a as an equal two theory where the representation an equal four super mills is an equal two theory where the representation is the joint representation. In particular, it's a real representation, and you have an USP2, which means SU2 flavor symmetry, which commutes with an equal two supersymmetry. It's really an R symmetry from the point of view of an equal four super mills, but in particular, because you have a mass deformation in this associated with the Cartan of this SU2, which you can use to deform n equal four square mills to what's called n equal two star. So it's believed that this mass deformation preserves as duality the gauge coupling. under as duality, this flavor symmetry is just unaffected. But so this is just the basic example of an equal truth gauge theory as duality, but it's also a pretty boring example. Actually, I should keep writing here. A more interesting example is a theory with is what's called an F equal to 4 SU2 gauge theory. So this means that I take an SU2 gauge group, and as a matter theory, is that I get 4 copies of the fundamental representation of SU2. The fundamental of SU2 is pseudo-real. So, so there is a flavor symmetry, which is SO8. So this theory was discussed in depth by Saber and Witten, and so the beta function for the gauge coupling is exactly cancelled once you have 4 fundamental flavors. And so you still have a marginal gauge coupling. For certain reasons, it's actually convenient to change the normalization slightly with respect of that canonical normalization up there. So if you write tau as 8 pi squared I over g squared plus theta over pi, then this theory still enjoys an SL2Z duality group, S duality group.
All over the place.
You know, I can never remember. I should remove the square. Huh? Okay. Thank you. Yeah, I guess the ratio of the true is 8 pi squared. Yeah, thank you. Okay. So this S-duality group is again generated by an S transformation, which sends tau to minus 1 over tau, and by a T transformation, sends tau to tau plus 1. Now, you might be a little bit surprised here, because I said that the theta angle is periodicity 2 pi, classically. But this is shifting the theta angle by pi. And if I shift the theta angle by pi, I'm in a configuration with its instant to number 1, it would look like the theory is changing. On the other hand, because I have this extra matter in upper multiplets, it turns out that in the ground of one instant, we have certain fermionic zero modes. And you can make up this change in sign by changing the sign of one of these zero modes. In particular, what concretely that means is that classically, this SO8 was actually an O8. There is a symmetry which reflects one of the half hypermultiplets. So there are, this SO8 in a sense is acting on 8 half hypermultiplets, each sitting, 2 and 2 bar. 2 bar is the same as 2. This symmetry, this Z2 symmetry is anomalous, exactly because there are of the fermion zero modes which are present in instant in configurations with instant number. But it can be used to make up for the change in sign when you shift data. But so this means that this when you do tau to tau plus 1, you should also do a reflection. The reflection does not commute with SO8. O8 is not just SO8 times Z2. Rather, it's an outer automorphism of SO8. It exchanges the spinor and cospinor representations of SO8. So tau to tau plus 1 is acting in a non-trivial fashion on, of the ferrosymmetry group. Now, if you want S and T to really form an SL2Z group, and all the usual relations of SL2Z to close nicely, you might expect that maybe S will also act non-trivially on the ferrosymmetry group. And indeed, whatever was your original matter content, if you do an S-duality, you need new dual degrees of freedoms to be generated, which will play the role of the old degrees of freedom. Here you had a bunch of hypermultiplets sitting in the fundamental, in the vector representation of SO8. If you do tau to minus 1 over tau, you will replace them with some magnetically charged, with some other magnetically charged degrees of freedoms, which are essentially were magnetic monopoles in the original theory. And if you look at how the ferrosymmetry group acts on a magnetic monopole, you'll see something pretty interesting. First of all, you might ask, why would the ferrosymmetry of the theory act on a magnetic monopole at all? Magnetic monopole is really just what you get by quantizing a smooth configuration of the gauge fields. But again, in the background of magnetic monopole, you get some fermionic zero modes from the hypermultiplets. And so you need to quantize the fermionic zero modes. These fermionic zero modes sit in a vector of SO8. When you quantize them, you essentially get gamma matrices. And you get the particles in this that you get out of this magnetic monopole classical configuration will have an action of these gamma matrices of SO8. And so they will be spinners of SO8. And you can show that they will be either chiral or anti-chiral spinners. So its duality exchanges the original vector, the original hypermultiplets in the vector of SO8 with hypermultiplets in a spinner of SO8. So it acts as a triality on SO8. So if you try to draw another picture like that, so here essentially, you had a modular region which looked like that. There was a weakly coupled region at tau equal to minus I infinity. And if you were everywhere else in the upper half plane, you could use an S-duality transformation to go back here. Use n equal 4. If you try to draw the same picture for an F equal to 4, but you're careful on the, if you keep carefully track of the behavior of the ferrosymmetry group, you will not have a single cusp, because you want to distinguish the situation where your elementary fields transform in a vector or a spinor or a cospinor of SO8 ferrosymmetry. And so you have a nice picture with three cusps. I hope I'll be able to draw it properly. So here I have tau goes to I infinity, and here I have tau goes to 0. And tau goes to 1. So here I have elementary fields in a vector. Here I have elementary fields in a spinner. And here I have elementary fields in a cospinner. OK.
Hypermultiplets,
yes. So so this is the basic result of something like Peter. And I'm going to see how much millage can I get out of this. And it's quite a bit. So let me see where to go down. So this is a list of basic building blocks I will use. OK. So what is the next simplest n equal to gauge theory I can think of? I want to make it exactly marginal. I want to keep using SU2 gauge groups because I understand them very well. So I can have two SU2 gauge groups. If I want an asymptotically free theory, actually, if I want a conformal field theory, I am pretty restricted on the sort of matter fields I can add. If you add anything that is not adjoint or fundamental or bifundamental, you get a beta function which gives an infrared free theory instead of an asymptotically free. So all I can do really is to put the bifundamental Let me call this SU21 and SU22. I can put the bifundamental representation. And so that counts for each as two fundamentals for each cage group. And then I want to add fundamentals, two fundamentals for the first gauge group and two fundamentals for the second gauge group. You can describe this theory with a sort of traditional quiver diagram this way. Two as you choose, with two fundamentals each, and then bifundamental. But quiver diagrams are not terribly useful here because they don't keep good track of the flavor symmetries of your theory. What are the flavor symmetries of this theory? The bifundamental is a real representation. It's a product of two pseudo-real representations. So it has a USP2 or SU2 flavor symmetry. Each of these has an SO4 flavor symmetry because it's two copies of a pseudo-real representation. And I'm going to decompose this SU4 into two SU2s. So this nice theory has five flavor symmetry groups. Actually, these duality properties of this theory had been discussed originally by in a paper of Argyres and a student, although they didn't pursue the question of how does duality act on the flavor symmetry groups, which is the crucial question I want to ask now. So first of all, why would I expect any S duality at all? Well, if you suppose that, so this theory has two marginal gauge couplings, one for each gauge group. As duality is really the statement is that if I take the Lagrangian of SU2 and F equal to 4 at this value of the coupling, or I take the Lagrangian at this value of the couplings, I get two identical conformal field theories. The statement should not be affected by the by gauging some extra flavor symmetry of this theory. So especially if I keep my second gauge group very weakly coupled, I don't expect to see anything strange to happen to the S-duality of the other node. So I can start from a configuration where both gauge groups are weakly coupled. It's a sort of a corner of my parameter space. Then I can move along the boundaries of this parameter space. I can keep this gauge group weakly coupled and bring this to be strongly coupled and do an S-duality. So I get a new weakly coupled gauge group. Then I can make this strongly coupled and do S-duality, and so on and so forth. I can keep iterating S-dualities on the two sides. Now, naively, the two S-duality groups would not talk to each other. I would have an SL2Z here, an SL2Z here. I want to show you that this assumption cannot be true. Now, but to do that, I need to first answer the very basic question. What happens if I make this gauge coupling strong and I do a S-duality in this middle node? How does the structure of the theory change? To do that, I need to essentially to follow how S-duality was acting on that SU2 gauge group, which I'm gauging with the second gauge group. So to the SU2 flavor symmetry, which I'm gauging at the second node. Now here I described everything in terms of this SO8 flavor symmetry. I treated all the four flavors of SU2 in the same footing. Here the four flavors of this SU2 node are distinguished into two fundamental flavors and one bifundamental. So I should break SO8 to SO4 times SO4. One SO4 is this SO4. The other SO4 is the product of this SU2 and the SU2 I'm gauging. So I should ask, how does triality act on the SO4 times SO4 subgroup of SO8? Now, this is an easy question to answer.
So let me take this SO4 times this SO4 inside SO8. The vector representation of SO8 is the sum of the vectors of one SO4 and the other SO4. Each of the vectors of the vector of this SO4 is really the product of the two fundamentals of the two SO2s inside SO4. So I get 2A times 2B plus 2C times 2. Well, okay, let me just forget about that theory for a moment. I'm just studying n equal force n f equal to 4. Okay. And inside here I have SU2A times SU2B times SU2C times SU2D inside SU8. This is the composition of the vector. If I look at the spinor representation, I want to build a spinor of SO8, I'll take the product of the spinors of SO4 and SO4 and do a chirality projection. And the result is 2A times 2C plus 2B times 2D. While the cospinor is 2A times 2D plus 2B times 2C. So you see, what this duality does is it permutes the way the various four SU2 flavor groups act on the matter. There is a very convenient way to draw this. See, so each fundamental of SU2 carries other two flavor groups. So let me just draw this configuration as the following. So what I mean with this picture is that I have an SU2 gauge group, each coupled to two set of two fundamentals, and each set of fundamentals carries the action of three SU2 groups, the one I'm gauging, and the two flavor groups. So when you see a picture like this, it really means that I have an SU2 gauge group coupled to two sets of fundamentals. And as the S transformation, so the T transformation, which exchanges 8S with 8C, it's really just exchanging C and D. And the S is sort of an ST channel duality. Okay. So in these pictures, remind you of pictures of conformal blocks or things like that, and they should. So. Right, let me just write it here. So I just want to remind you. So an F equal to 4 is going to be labeled by something like this. I will also label the old n equal to Starture n equal to Fourier Mills with this picture. But in a sense, if I take this set of so these are really hypermultiplets in a tri-fundamental the transforming in the three SU2 flavor groups, if I take the diagonal of two of these, I'm gonna get a 3+1. So an adjoint plus something not charged under the group. So if I draw something like this, I mean that I'm taking SU2 gauge theory coupled to the adjoint, to a field in adjoint representation. So this picture represents an equal 2 star.
I think so. So it just.
So it goes between HC and HS?
That's right, because you see, to go between HC and HS, I have to exchange C and D.
I guess it's on the first one.
And I do nothing to HV.
No, sorry. So,
I think the confusion is that this usually fixed. The confusion I think is that you usually fix A, B, C, V, and you change the lines and you did the opposite, but it's the same.
So
in the first picture,
yes,
you change the labels of the lines.
The site and here too.
Yes, but I think maybe the confusion was that if you wrote C upstairs and D downstairs and cross the lines. From the S channel to the U channel.
Sorry. So T is a pretty trivial operation, right? It doesn't really change the Lagrangian you were working with. It just changes the labels C and D. S is a more non-trivial transformation. It really changes the Lagrangian you have. Because now you have hypermultiplets charged under SU2A times SU2C. Here you didn't. I don't know.
So these are not. So this corresponds to the tasks tau equal to I infinity, tau equal to zero, and tau equal to one. So near tau equal to I infinity, the theory has this description. Near tau equal to zero, the theory has this description. Near tau equal to 1, the theory has this description. Tau goes to tau plus 1, leaves this description more or less invariant, after changes the labeling a little. sorry, I forgot to put the label. Okay, now back to this theory we want to study. Sorry for the long detour. Now, if I want to describe this theory with a picture like this, we want to draw something like this.
I think what David said is that T don't act on the vector, well, the first diagram on the T acts on the vector.
Well, T does not act on the vector, but it changes the way the legs are labeled. Yeah. It's a very small change. It's an O in S in OA, but it's still an outer automorphism of the flavor group. So T acts as an outer automorphism. Now you might not be able to be happy with the labeling things just by these prevalent graphs. Indeed, we'll get back to very soon to better labeling, which is a bit more sensitive to these shift.
I think even in your original diagram, if you just extend C and D,
yes,
between HS and HC. Mm-hmm. It's the same relation that you are trying to draw.
Yeah.
So it is the labeling is different in the T diagram versus the way you are drawn, but otherwise the statement is same.
Sorry.
what I'm trying to say is that what you have written is right. It is just that the labelings are a little different. That's why it looks different. But if you look at the original diagram written for HS and HC and just extend C and D,
I was just trying to show how the fields in the Lagrangian. So this describes a certain Lagrangian description at tau equal to I infinity. I'm doing tau goes to tau plus 1. I get back the same Lagrangian description, but I've labeled the legs in a slightly different way to manifest the fact that SU2D and SU2C have been exchanged. That I did a Z2 automorphism of the flavor symmetry group. here I'm comparing two different Lagrangians because S does that. So maybe that's part of the confusion. But I'm just showing what are the autistic field content before and after the S-12 transformation. So it looks like an ST channel diagram. And the ST2 gauge group, flavor groups will get paired up in a different fashion. So here I'm describing a theory with two SU2 gauge groups. This is the two fundamentals, transforming SU2A times SU2B. This is the bifundamental field with an SU2C flavor group. And this is the other fundamental. Okay. So what happens if I do S duality, the first node? Let me call it S1. Oh, I do my S channel. Okay, so here I started from tau. I started from what naively is tau 1 equal to the I infinity and tau 2 equal to I infinity. And I went to tau 1 equal to 0, well, near 0, and tau 2 near I infinity. Okay, and I did an S-duality transformation. So I'm moving along the boundary of my moduli space. Now, I would like to make a duality transformation to the second node, what looks like S2. That is right. So I need to do this. So if you want, at the first step, I ended up exchanging B and C, if you compare the matter content of the two theories. At the next step, I'm exchanging basically D and B. Now, you can already see that the S-duality is really acting as a permutation on these five groups. It really doesn't look like the product of two S or two Zs. But let's make it manifest. Let's keep going around. Now I want to do S1 again. So I want to do S-duality at this node. I mean, I should really leave the label of which nodes I'm talking about. That side. And now I might expect that if the group was really SL2Z times SL2Z, if I do a second S2 transformation, I should go back to the original theory. So let's see what happens instead. Side. C. Okay, this definitely is not the original theory. Although I could get that by a final S1. So instead of getting a Z2, I'm getting a sort of a pentagon relation. So the group is the S-duality group is definitely not this one. On the other hand, here I've essentially gone through all possible ways of distributing my five SU2 gauge groups
substitute flavor group labels over this diagram. So it looks like I really have five different Lagrangian descriptions of the theory. Well, five different ways of labeling the flavor symmetries of the theory, which are exchanged by some unknown S-duality group. So you might ask what's going on. If I had assumed that my S-duality group was really tau 1 goes to minus 1 over tau 1, tau 2 goes to tau 2, I would get a contradiction. So what happened to my S-duality transformations? Well, back to the answer, I believe, is that this theory is also finite, still have some finite renormalization. So there's a certain degree of ambiguity in deciding what the a certain amount of scheme dependence in deciding what the gauge coupling of your theory is. Now, although when I do an S1 transformation, although the second gauge group is not touched, the only thing I'm touching is what matrix transforming under it. Well, the matter was making up this bifundamental here, the matter which is making up this bifundamental here are completely different. This was some electrically charged, some hypermultiplets. This is some dual hypermultiplets, completely different particles. So you can expect that somehow the one loop correction, for example, from integrating away one group or the other group of particles might be shifted by some finite amount. So this transformation should actually be should actually have some corrections, some instanton corrections, really, which go to zero when this gauge coupling is very weak, but become important when you then do S-duality for the second gauge coupling. So well, I will. So, well, for now, you seem to have a sort of the groupoid. Okay. You see, here I had two basic elementary moves done on a trivalent graph. I had a T move, which was rotating two legs with respect to the other two, and I had an S move, which was doing sort of S of T. Channel transformation, okay? These two elements are well-defined for this sort of, for this other type of trivalent graph. So for it, I have an S and T move here, and I have an S and T move here. I can take them as generators and take this, the group generated by these, four generators up to the relation that if I go back to the same drawing, to the same Lagrangian with the same labeling of flavor groups, I'm really going back to the same theory. So that should be.
Is this the only relation? How do you know there are no other relations?
Well, there are all the relations which correspond to graphical operations which bring me back to the same graph.
This is the only one you're saying?
No, there is another is called the hexagon relation. This is a very well known groupoid of transformations. It's a more subtle groupoid. It was introduced originally to study the behavior of conformal blocks in rational conformal field theories. If you have a conformal block in a rational conformal field theory, you can do this sort of T move or this S move, but they're called really A and B moves by Moore and Sager. Of course, this suggests that maybe instead of using these diagrams, you should actually use label this by sort of pair of plans, the compositions of the surface. But I'll get to that in a moment. Before that, I would like to try to discuss the topic in general. So this is a very instructive example. What is the more general set of conformal invariant theories which we can build out of C2 gauge groups and sort of matter fields, fundamental matter fields. So, I can surely, the first step I could consider a tree node quiver with three SU2 gauge groups. Okay? with bifundamentals between consecutive gauge groups and a pair of fundamentals at the end, so that all three gauge couplings are exactly marginal. So if I draw the picture to describe the flavor symmetries and matter content of this theory, I will draw something like this. Well, these are the three gauge groups. And I have a total of six SU2 flavor groups. And now I can do, of course, S duality at each of the nodes. It's particularly instructive to do S duality at the middle node. Actually, not really S duality, more like doing the U duality, the one that the combination of S and T, which brings these two legs together. Because then you go to this Lagrangian. So this is the first example in which S duality does not bring a theory to the same theory with a different labeling of the flavor groups. It really brings you to a different theory. So even if you ignore the information about the flavor groups, S duality will relate different looking theories. In this theory, I have some matter fields in a trifundamental of the three gauge groups. So, you see, you can start with a pair of fundamentals of a gauge group. These carry two SU2 flavor symmetries. You can gauge one of these two SU2 flavor symmetries, and you get the bifundamental, which still has an SU2 flavor symmetry. And finally, you can gauge that SU2 flavor symmetry to get the trifundamental representation. It's just the standard Lagrangian with. So this had a representation which was something like this had two fundamentals, a bifundamental, a bifundamental, two fundamentals. It had two fundamentals, two fundamentals, two fundamentals for each of the three gauge groups. And one trifundamental. So it's still three SU2 gauge groups, it's still the same amount of matter, but it's gauged along a different pattern. So each of these things is like eight half-hyper multiples, eight carat, Nicol one carat fields. So this theory has 4 × 8 = 32 carat fields. This theory also has 32 carat fields, but they're gauged along a different pattern. So now, once I admit five fundamentals, I can get very interesting things. I mean, if you think in terms of standard quivers, all you could think of doing would be linear quivers of SU2 gauge groups or necklace quivers, which are a sort of generalization of Nicol 4 superior mills, which is a necklace of bifundamentals. But once you realize that each of these bifundamentals have a third SU2 flavor symmetry, then you can do more interesting things. For example, why don't I do something like this? You can gauge the diagonal of these two SU2 flavor symmetries. So I get a theory with six gauge groups. Each of the nodes either looks like locally, only looks like either an SU2 with an F equal to 4, like this guy, which is coupled to two trifundamentals, so a total of 4 flavors. Or gauge groups which look like SU2 with n equal to star, which are coupled to an adjoint representation. Of course, you can also do, so you can do a variety of things. You can do something like this. No, three gauge groups coupled to true trifundamentals. So in general, you get to do a lot of possible theories, a theory for each of these trivalent graphs. And then by doing the basic S-duality moves at the intermediate nodes, you can relate different graphs, different prevalent graphs and different theories. Well, you get the point. And actually, just a little bit of inspection shows you that all sorts of graphs which have the same matter content and the same number of gauge groups can be related by these zestualities. So just by moving along the boundary of the parameter space, just by using the two basic zestualities, you can build a very intricate network. So you really get a picture like this. It's convenient to say that the number of SU2 gauge groups is It's convenient so what are the invariants? As I said, all theories with the same number of gauge groups and the same number of trifundamental hypermultiples can be related by zestualities. It's actually convenient to label things by the number of loops in the graphs and by the number of flavor groups. So if I have G loops and N SU2 flavor groups, I need something like SU2 to the N plus 3G minus 3 gauge groups. And something like N plus 2G minus 2 trifundamentals. So I can get a theory labeled by this G and N. And it has a very intricate parameter space, which I will conjecture very soon. And it has many different descriptions which correspond to different trivalent diagrams, many different weakly coupled Lagrangians in corners of the moduli space, which correspond to trivalent graphs. So say if I was looking at genus 0 and 6 flavor groups, I have all this sort of et cetera, et cetera. And I can move along them by using the basic S and T duality moves. So first of all, it's pretty clear already that the S duality group, we should make a nice table of properties of these theories. Okay. So we have theory tau, G, and N. So it has Lagrangian descriptions that are labeled by trivalent graphs, or better, pair of Pan's decompositions of the Riemann surface, which you get by fattening up the trivalent graph. Yeah. So there is a relation between these and some Riemann surface genus G and then punctures. There is an S duality groupoid. It's not a group anymore because it doesn't send you back to the same theory. So each S-duality move really has to have two labels that tell you which theory do you start from and which theory do you arrive to. So it's a group void, a bunch of apples, which are compositional rule, and inverses. And this seems to coincide with the move Seiberg. Groupoid. Which is the groupoid generated by elementary moves relating different pair of pants decomposition of the same Riemann surface. Now, what is the parameter space of couplings that this groupoid is this S-duality groupoid is acting upon? The same way as the S-duality for the two-node quiver was not a self choose Z squared anymore, you expect that the parameter space of gauge couplings will not be just the product of two upper half planes. Somehow something interesting must be happening from coupling to open up a more intricate set of asymptotic directions. So if you think about it, well, of course, so we don't know what the full moduli space is a priori, but we do know something. We do know that if you have some complicated trivalent graph corresponding to some Riemann surface, okay. Hope I'm going it right. Okay. And if I focus on a single leg, on a single handle of this surface, on a single gauge group, then at least when this gauge group is very weakly coupled, I should be able to describe the parameter space. I don't know how the parameter space of this piece of the theory could be. I don't know what the parameter space of this piece of this theory could be. But so I have some M1, then so M2. But I know that if the weak cup with the cage coupling is very, very weak, the two theories are not talking to each other. So I should be getting the product of the parameter spaces, approximately at least. And then I should get the upper half plane, which describes the weakly coupled region of this gauge coupling. So the full parameter space should emit a nice decomposition near each of the cusps into the product of the parameter spaces of two fragments together with the upper half plane. Or better, a parameter Q equal to e to the 2 pi I tau. Sorry, pi I tau. 2 pi I tau. Yes. Which looks a lot, now this parameter looks a lot like the parameter you use to describe the way of gluing together two Riemann surfaces. If you have two Riemann surfaces and you want to glue them together, you depict two points on the Riemann surfaces with local coordinates z1 and z2. And you build a new Riemann surface by a surgery, we identify z1, z2 equal to q. And then you make a handle between the two Riemann surfaces, which become long and thin as q goes to zero or tau goes to infinity. Okay, so this is the. Now, of course, you can also consider situations where a handle of the Riemann surface is. Splitting. And then again, you expect the parameter space of the theory in the limit of this gauge coupling is very weak to be identical to the parameter space of the theory where I broke this leg, where I remove this gauge group times the gauge coupling for this gauge group. So we have moduli space, we have a move, it's acted upon by the Mohs-Seiberg groupoid,
textualities. It has natural coordinate systems near each of the tasks, given by the set of QIs for each of the handles that you're cutting, making them thin. So it's natural to conjecture to the parameter space. It's the same as the Fuller moduli space of a Riemann surface in genus G and in functions. So that the complex structure of the Riemann surface really encodes the gauge couplings of this theory.
Okay.
I'll get to that. I'll get to that in due time. Now, I would like to express a very simple thought. If I compute anything in the four-dimensional gauge theory, in some Lagrangian description of the four-dimensional gauge theory, that something will have to be acted upon by the exploited transformation. It will have to be a function of the parameter space. So you'll get quantities, functions on the moduli space of Riemann surfaces with good transformations under most other groupoid transformations, with good limits when the Riemann surface splits or simplifies. That sounds like two-dimensional conformal theory, objects, or in general, objects associated with the Riemann surface. So you predict, at least in principle, a whole set of dualities, because every object in the four-dimensional field theory should be dual to some object in the theory of Riemann surfaces. So this was this would be the main, the recurrent theme in the cycle of lectures. So but for example, we will see that the partition function of the theorem S4 coincides with the theory correlation function of this Riemann surface. We'll see that the spectrum of line operator, well, not we. Somebody else has seen that the spectrum of line operators, protective line operators in the gauge theory, correspond to the, is labeled by paths on the Riemann surface. We'll see how to describe the BPS spectrum of the four-dimensional theory in terms of quantities in principle of the Riemann surface, and so on and so forth. But and really, the basis of all those relations is just a very simple statement that here I have an S duality, which is identical to the full saddle proportion.
Okay, so any questions before I continue? So next I would like to try to answer Natalia's question of what happens if I don't look at the C2 gauge groups. So so of course until now this looked like more or less conjectures, although they are very well motivated conjectures. Tomorrow we'll reinforce them by conjecturing again the Saber-Witten curve, which describes low energy dynamics of these theories, and recovering the behavior of, I mean, recovering a structure which knows about the Riemann, the underlying Riemann surface. And then, you know, we'll try to find various ways of identifying the physical meaning of this Riemann surface. Because, of course, if you're just given a four dimensional gauge theory, why would you start thinking about Riemann surfaces? But there are actually physical quantities which see the Riemann surface, literally. For example, we will find some operators which are labeled by points on the Riemann surface, some operators in the four-dimensional gauge theory. Why am I erasing this? Sorry, I just meant to bring this down. So, what about other gauge groups? let's start with SU3. So what tests you three theories we know with the non-estuality transformations? Well, of course, there is an equal force pyramids. That's a bit boring again. Now, and then there is another natural SU3 theory with a marginal gauge coupling constant, marginal gauge coupling, which is SU3 with six flavors. In general, if the number of flavors is twice the number of colors, the beta function for the gauge group, for the gauge coupling is zero in equal two gauge theories. Now, this theory looks very similar in many ways to SU2 with four flavors, but there is one very crucial difference. It has only an EU6 flavor symmetry group, because the fundamental of SU3 is not it's not pseudo-real. This prevents us from saying that tau goes to tau plus 1 is a symmetry, because I don't have available, I cannot reflect half an hypermultiplet to make up for the sign I get from reflecting, from shifting the theta angle by pi only. It's just no notion of a half hypermultiplet. So the only symmetry is under tau goes to tau plus 2. There is still an S-duality. Tau goes to minus 1 over tau. But that's not enough somehow to cover all the possible casks in the moduli space. So so the effect of this S-duality, this S-duality is still interesting on the flavor group. See, the hypermultiplets will transform in a 6 of SU6 with charge 1 under U1. And S-duality exchanges them with hypermultiplets, magnetically dual hypermultiplets, which are still in a vector of, sorry, in a fundamental of SU6, but with opposite charge under the U1. So I still have the same picture with three casts. Up here, I have matter in the 6 plus. Down here, matter in the 6 minus, but the tau equal to 1, I was called a very strongly coupled point, where for a very long while, people just didn't know what the theory would look like. It's not even clear that there would be a weakly coupled description of any sort. Now, recently, Argyris and Seiberg put a name to this question mark. They argued that while in these two casts, some SU3 gauge fields are becoming weakly coupled, in this third cast, only an SU2 gauge field appear, which is weakly coupled. So at this third cast, there will be an SU2 gauge field, but you can argue that this SU2 gauge field cannot be coupled to standard hypermultiplets. Things will just not work out. So this SU2 gauge field should be still coupled to some strongly interacting theory. Argyris and Seiberg argued that it should be coupled to, well, one lone fundamental of SU2 plus what's called the E6 SCFD. So from the old days of string theory constructions, people knew that there are some strongly interacting superconformal field theories with n equal to supersymmetry, no Lagrangian description, and with exceptional flavor symmetries. And Argyris and Seiberg conjecture is that the description of this question mark point is that you take the E6 superconformal field theory, you pick an SU2 time SU6 subgroup of E6, and you gauge this SU2 ferrosymmetry together with the ferrosymmetry of a lone fundamental hypermultiplet. So SU6 live inside the E6 CFT. The U1 is just the SO2 ferrosymmetry of this guy. So Well, this is a very beautiful result. They tested it extensively. Well, as extensively as you reasonably could, considering that you can compute very little about this CFT. So they checked that the conjecture works at the level of subgravitation curves. They also verified that the beta function of this SU2 gauge group is really zero if you couple it to one fundamental and to this subgroup of V6. Because luckily, you can compute the beta function just from the current correlation functions for the favorable symmetries of this E6 CFT. So it must be that because SU2 and SU6 are inside the same E6, the flavor currents for this SU6 must have the same coefficient, which is related in a certain way to the flavor currents for this SU2. And these are exactly this is exactly the coefficient that you need for the conformal inverse of this SU2 gauge coupling. So, and then there was a matching of anomalies, I think. Well, I think there was also matching of some, anyway. Okay, so what can we learn out of this? I mean, this is not as convenient as the as duality of SU2 and F equal to 4, but let's see if we can learn something just from first principles. Again, why do I erase this? Was it? Is it? Okay. Then I will have to erase something finally. Then I erase this. So there is no way to get to the one up there. That's unfortunate. You should provide a little staircase. So now it turns out that there is a, if you look at all literature about gauge theory unifications, for example, or just do your group theory, you can find three independent SU3 subgroups inside E6. So when a so which are completely equivalent. The SU2 that Argyris and Saber were looking at sits inside one of the S3s, and the SU6 is made out of the other two SU3s together with the U1, which commutes with the SU2 in SU3. Now, it turns out that the anomaly, the current correlation function for these SU3 flavor groups is exactly half of what you need for an SU3 gauge group to be exactly marginal. So let me represent this theory again with a picture of this source. Okay? But this just means that I have three SU3 favor groups. And let's see if I can draw a picture like this meaningfully. So this means that they took two copies of the E6 theory and a gauge with an SU3 gauge group, the diagonal of two SU3 flavors inside the E6s. Now, can we somehow argue that there should be an S-duality transformation of this sort? If we can do that, then we are in business. We can repeat all the reasonings we had for the SU2 theories, just replace the tri-fundamental hypermultiplets with copies of this E6 theory. Right, and instead I want to work with SU3 coupled to two E6s. So how can I do that? Well, there is a trick, of course. There are always tricks. So the statement of Argyris-Seiberg is that if I take this theory And well, now I really don't have a good way to draw this, but I'll do my best. And you gauge an SU2. I can use a sort of an hybrid notation. So I gauge an SU2 together with a single fundamental. This would be the same as an SU3 gauge theory with six flavors. I split the six flavors into two. So I can see better that there is two SU3 gauge groups, two SU3 flavor groups, which correspond to this. So there are really two U3 flavor groups. So SU3 times C1 and SU3 times C1. So all subgroups of the overall U6 flavor group of the theory. And so these are SU3A and SU3B. Then I have a flavor symmetry for this guy. And there is another U1 inside the SU3 that commutes with SU2. Sorry, I really wish I had a good way to draw this, but I couldn't find it yet. And these two U1s are combinations of these two U1s. OK? I don't know how to write it, but I don't want to get there too early. So suppose that now I start with this theory. And as a convenient tool, I do the same thing to both these legs. So I gauge two SU2 groups together with two fundamentals. Now, this theory, because of Argyris-Seiberg, is related to this. So now I have three groups. If I do Argyris-Seiberg duality here, I get another SU3. If I do Argyris-Seiberg duality here, I get another SU3. So I get a three-node quiver with three SU3 gauge groups. So this theory has U3 flavor groups at the end, which correspond to these flavor groups here. And then it has a U1 inside U3, and then a U1 for each of these by fundamentals. OK, so my favorite groups is two SU3s and 1, 2, 3, and 4 U1s. Now, I know that the standardized duality for SU3 permutes the two U1s. Well, I didn't say that. So when you send 6 plus to 6 minus, U6 is really the same thing as exchanging U1A and U1B and leave SU3A and SU3B untouched. In a sense, U1A and U1B are the sum and difference of the U1s, of the U1 inside U6, and of the U1 inside SU6, which commutes the two SU3s. So if you change the sign of this U1, it's like exchanging these two U1s. So as duality exchanges this. It means that by doing standardized dualities at these three nodes, I can reassemble, I can mix among themselves however I want, permute among themselves however I want these four U1 groups. So I do Argyris-Seiberg to do here. I do standardized dualities to permute the SU groups, the U1 groups. And then I go back. I can very easily, so here there was. I do a Argyris-Seiberg duality again back. Here I had some U1s. So I had an SU3, and inside I had the SU2 I gauged times U1. Okay. And what I'm saying is that by doing this chain of dualities, I can go back to the same picture, but permuting these two U1s. So I take it as a very strong evidence that there is this duality which actually permutes the labels, which actually permutes these two labels here. Now, together with the trivial T transformation, which exchanges this, I want to say that we managed to provide some evidence that the basic generators of the Cybermoor groupoid should be still there. So now I can draw my favorite pictures with a bunch of E6. So with the N plus 2G minus 2 E6 theories and N plus 3G minus 3 SU3 gauge groups, and argue that all possible graphs that I can draw should correspond to different cusps of the same theory. Yes, I'm really still drawing Riemann surfaces. Just a moment. I haven't gotten there yet. So just a moment. So at this first step, what I get are, you know, like Riemann surfaces with functions. And now, so before each puncture was labeling an SU2 flavor group, and now each puncture is labeling an SU3 flavor group. So from this point of view, the E6 theory is just a sphere with three punctures. Okay. Now, after I discussed the Cybermoor groupoid for these basic objects, which only have E6 groups and SU3 groups, I can try to further decorate these theories by adding on the outside legs the SU2 gauge groups with U1s. So now I get theories where the flavor symmetries are either SU3s or U1s. And Saber duality is consistent with the statement that if I take one of these SU3s and I gauge the SU2 subgroup, I go to a theory which still has two of these big punctures and sort of two tiny punctures. I mean, had two punctures associated to SU3 gauge group flavor groups and two punctures associated to U1 flavor groups. And if I cut it like this, I'm describing the standard SU3 theory with six flavors. And if I'm cutting it like this, well, cutting means that I'm making, I'm going to some cusp in the modular space or some other cusp, I recover the E6 theory plus SU2 gauge group. Okay? So the full family of theories really should be labeled by the number of punctures of the two types. I have some theory T of G N1 and 2, if you want, which has N1 SU3 flavors and N2 U1. Okay? And the S-duality relations that we can get are compatible with the statement that all possible cusps in the parameter space, I mean, are compatible with the statement that the gauge coupling parameter space is the same, is still the parameter space of Riemann surface with two types of punctures. And the various cusps of this parameter space correspond to all possible ways of realizing this theory as a bunch of E6 blocks and a bunch of SU3 gauge groups and SU2 gauge groups and single fundamentals.
Position U is
that,
does the cutoff correspond to
a big patch? That's right, because we need to have an SU3 flavor group to gauge. Okay.
Can you collide the function?
Sure. So this is the same as a scuffing. You know, in a Riemann surface, if you collide punctures, it's like cutting off a three puncture sphere. Okay. So if you collide two of these punctures, you get back a full puncture.
Anyway, if you collide anything, you get a big cut or a big puncture here. So we got another larger class of theories, again associated to Riemann surface and punctures. I cannot say anymore Lagrangian descriptions. I'm sort of pseudo Lagrangian descriptions. The matter theory is strongly interacting. You don't have a Lagrangian for it, but at least the gauge groups are weakly coupled and can be described by Lagrangian. So in principle, if you knew the correlation functions of the matter theories, you could do a perturbation theory in the gauge couplings using the correlation functions of the matter theory. Of course, we don't know them, so that's a little bit less useful. And we get nice spatiality group, et cetera, et cetera. And again, we expect all sorts of quantities which could, in principle, compute in these theories. We have nice modular properties on the Riemann surface that correspond to certain objects which live naturally on the Riemann surface. Now, if you try to extend this to more gauge groups, to more complicated gauge groups, you can. Unfortunately, you don't have a more cyber duality, sorry, actually a cyber duality to refer to anymore. So it would be more natural to discuss it after we have some other tools like subalgebraic T-curves for these theories. But I can anticipate that you're going to get theories labeled by Riemann surface with various sort of punctures. The punctures carry some extra data, some sort of label which tells you which sort of puncture you have. And depending on this data, they will be associated with various favorable groups. There will be a very special puncture that you get when you break handles on the Riemann surface, and a variety of other ones. And most of the matter theories which we get, so they correspond to three puncture spheres with three different choices of labels. And most of these will be strongly interacting superconformal field theories, which are previously unknown. So they generalize this sort of fixed theory, but generally they don't have enhanced symmetry. For example, the basic building block only has SUN, 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 which do not get to sit into bigger group. In a sense, one of the final results is that most n equal 2 theories, so let's say this right. So if you start from standard quivers with Lagrangian description and a bunch of unitary rules, say, and bifundamentals between them, so they're conformally invariant, you get the statement that most of the tasks in the parameter space are described by more intricate theories where the matter content is strongly interactive. And furthermore, you can build a much larger class of theories where you just start with a bunch of strongly interacting building blocks and gauge their favorite symmetries. So the final result is that you get a very huge class of n equal 2 theories with these beautiful properties. The most known theories are a subset of that, but there are many more. So in a sense, from this point of view, theories with Lagrangian are rather small and in a sense a natural subset of all n equal 2 gauge theories. And I think this is one of the most striking results here, that there are many more n equal 2 field theories than you could have guessed. And I'm really curious to know if this is something that is specific on n equal 2 or if it's a generic statement. So it's possible this extreme variety of basic building blocks is available only because of n equal 2 supersymmetry, but it's also possible that they are a generic feature of, say, n equal 1, 2, or n equal 0.
So you argue that there's a huge class of theories, but most of them you can't write anything about them.
But you can give a sort of roundabout definition in four dimensions of the basic building blocks you're using to define them. You can give a uniform description in terms of the six-dimensional theory, although the six-dimensional theory itself is not a Lagrangian.
Can you calculate anything from it?
You can compute a surprising amount of things. You can compute the subalgebraic curve for all of them. You can compute, in principle, the spectrum BPS states for all of them. You can compute, in principle, the spectrum of line operators contact the line operators in normal and compute partition function on S4 and correlation function on S4 of all these objects. So it's
you can
in principle compute using a duality with two-dimensional conformal field theories. Often you relate them to correlation functions in total theories, which we don't know how to compute either, but are in principle more computable. I mean, yeah, they are really in principle computable. In the sense you can write the conformal block to our theory and then just assemble, if you knew the treatment functions of total, all the treatment functions of total, you could assemble them into correlation functions.
And all these theories can be built out of those?
Yeah.
Can you store this, the Riemann surface structure also in the limit when you take the large N?
Sorry, in the large N? So all these theories also have an holographic dual, which is the explicitly the Riemann surface. So, again, so which means that if for SUN gauge loops, you can actually, you could actually do computations with non-supersymmetric quantities using the holographic dual. That's true. So there are some non-perfect quantities you could replace with one.
So could you use that to check this?
Well, first of all, you can check that the logarithmic dual has the correct parameter space and the correct functions. So all the labeling of functions, that it's pretty amusing that all the labeling of functions you find in, say, the six-dimensional definition theory, two-field theory, coincides with the punctures you get to see in supergravity in any theory, and coincides with the punctures that you see in tonal theories in two dimensions. In principle, for example, one should be able to check the expectation value of line operators against four against some holographic calculations, etc.
Can you deform this n equals 2 to n equals 1 by some mass deformations? And
yes, so,
the steps?
So there is a, I shouldn't say cheap, it's very interesting, but so you could keep the same building blocks, but gauge the field symmetries with n equal 1 gauge groups. So that's the route followed by Tachikawa and others, and Benigni and Tartaglia. So they study mass deformations of these n equal 2 theories in which you turn on the mass for the joint field. So you remove the joint fields in the vector multiplets. You're left with n equal 1 gauge groups gauging the field symmetries of these building blocks. A question which I would like to know if there are intrinsically n equal 1 building blocks. But yes, just out of this you can get a very large variety of n equal 1 super conformal field theories.
But can we use this to prove psi-regularity?
So people have tried to prove sub-duality out of n equal 2 as duality. They get pretty close, but not quite there.
But it was a long time ago.
Yes, it was a long time ago. It's unclear to me if this really adds new tools for proving the oldest sub-duality. What it might do definitely is to provide new sub-dualities, provide hints for new sub-dualities. So it wouldn't prove them, it wouldn't give you the full content of them the same way as it does for the original sub-duality. Of course, I cannot exclude, it's impossible that you might be able to get more insight into sub-duality, but I don't quite see simple. But you might be able to get more dualities. I think I don't understand is that the parameter space of all these negative theories always coincides with the Euler parameter space. I don't know why. I don't know which property of the Euler modular space. I could ask in principle what are the constraints on the parameter space of an n equal 2 conformal field theory. I have no idea why these constraints should always single out or almost always single out the Euler modular space. For n equal 1 theories, I think there is an interesting question to explore what is the parameter space of
possible Lagrange deformations.
So those which are obtained by the Chikawa method, they are also some.
Well, they get extra parameters because now they are superpotential. So you have voltage gauge couplings and superpotential couplings, and although beta function, the zero beta function constraint kills some of them, you still get many more than the ones you are getting for sure. So there's a question, what is the overall quantum space?
And if it's not CFD, then it's not Technurian, right?
Actually, it is.
It's still Technurian?
Yeah, yeah.
It's not
so here I gave you a story with conformality theories. But once you have conformality theories, it's very easy to get asymptotically free by just adding mass parameters from the matter and sending the mass parameters to infinity to remove the matter. So in a sense, you can take a true story and add, throw in another set of punctures which represent the presence of asymptotically free gauge groups. So all of these all these properties apply to asymptotically free theories too, and to other exotic ones as well, Archimedes Douglas theories and others. I can give you more details if you want after that.
Questions?